So before we start the share this evening, I just wanted to mention if anyone tried to get hold recently here in Israel of the 3-week Sefer From Ruins to Redemption, it was actually out of print. They sold out rapidly, but they did reprint actually, and copies should be available, Mitz Hashem, again in stores here in Eretz Yisrael in the next day or so. So feel free to check back in. This evening we have the final two parshos of Chumash Bamidbar, Matos and Maaseh, and let us try and dip into each of them. And we begin with the beginning of Parshas Matos, which deals with the inyan of Nedarim. Nedarim and Shavuos, if a person takes upon himself an oath or a vow, and closely associated with Nedarim and Shavuos, with the accepting of a Neder and a Shavuah, an oath and a vow, is the undoing, is the annulling. And that's the concept of Hataras Nedarim. And Rashi informs us that there are actually two ways that a person can get a Hatara, an annulment. This is not yet the whole issue of what a father can do, hafara, to disrupt a vow. This is actual hatara, to completely uproot the vow. And Rashi talks about this in his opening comment in the Parsha, Rashi Hamatos. It's a few lines in, because it's somewhat connected to another matter. The idea of Moshe speaking to Rashi Hamatos, what does that mean? One thing is for sure, it's mentioned explicitly and especially here, which means that there's special reference and relevance of the Roshi Hamatos, of the heads. What do they have to do with Nedarim? Says Rashi, Uma ra'a la'omra kan. Why, what did the Torah see, so to speak, to talk about this here? The heads of the Matos, the heads of the tribes, who represent the leaders. Lamad, Shafaras Nedarim, Biyochid Mumcha. This teaches us that it's possible to affect what he calls Hafaras Nedarim, halachically we'd call it Hataras Nedarim, with one expert judge. If he's a Mumcha, and there's much discussion as to what qualifies for a Mumcha, does he need smicha, of which we spoke about last week, or he needs just special expertise in the area of Nedarim? One person alone could issue a Hatara. V'im ein yachid Mumcha, and if there's no such expert around, mefer b'shlosha yotos. So one can achieve Hafara or Hatara with three regular people. And that, of course, is much closer to our experience. I mean, the closest we come on a regular basis to Hataras Nedarim is either Kol Nidre, where the Beis Din is actually harder to spot, or on Erev Rosh Hashanah, which has become the Minhag. A person stands before three Hedyotos. They have to know a thing or two about Nedarim, but they don't need to know that much more than a thing or two about Nedarim. We don't find people checking the expertise of Nedarim for their panel on Erev Rosh Hashanah. Hedyotos are enough. So these now are the two available options. You either have one individual who's an outstanding expert in the field, or you have three relatively knowledgeable people, and they could also issue a Hatara. What's interesting is, and what is pointed out by one of the great poskim of the early Acharonim, Rabbi Yerachayim Bachrach, in the response of Chavos Yoy, is that it seems that there is a preference between these two options. And the preference is actually to go for the one person who's an expert. If you have two available possibilities, you can either ask your Yochid Mumcha, the one expert, or three Adyotos, you go for the one. We might have thought they're equi-acceptable. But actually, no, there is an order of preference. And where do we draw this out from? Because Rashi effectively said this explicitly. He begins by saying, Hafaras Nadarin is b'yachid mumche, one expert. V'im ein yachid mumche, and if you don't have one expert, so then you go for the three hedyotos, which means that the expert is option A, plan A, and if you don't have that, so then you go for plan B, which is the three hedyotos. It also works. It works completely. But it's the less desirable or the less preferable of the two options. And the question is, why would this be? And where does this come from? And the answer of the Chavos Yair will tap us into a major principle with regards to Chumash and the Halacha, no less. Each of these, again, the individual expert and the three lay people, each of these works min haTorah, which means there's a source for both. What is the source for each of these things? Well, one, again, Rashi's already told us. The reference to Roshi HaMatos, which are the leaders, tells us that a leader is enough to do this. Interestingly, the heads of the Matos translate into an expert into Nedarim, but obviously an individual of distinction. That is the source in the Torah for the Yochid Mumcha, the words Roshi HaMatos. What about the idea that three lay people can also affect an annulment of Nedarim and Shavuos? Where does that come from? Well, Rashi makes reference to it a bit later in his comment. It's from the Gemara in Nedarim, Daf Ayin Ches. It's based on a Gezeirah Shavah. A Gezeirah Shavah is when, as we know, when you have the same word or phrase that appears in two areas of Torah, it allows for a flow of information, a transfer of halachic information between them. And the crucial words here are the words Zeh HaDavar, which is in our first pasuk, Zeh HaDavar. And that links us to another area in the Torah where it says Zeh HaDavar, which is Shchutei Chutz, back in Parshas Acharemos, where one cannot offer korbanos outside the Beis HaMikdash. And that applies to everyone, which teaches us that in the same way that Shchutei Chutz, that other area of Torah, is in the province of the entire Jewish people equally, so too, Hataras Nedarim is likewise in the province of the entire Jewish people equally. Now, there have to be more than one of them, otherwise what's the difference between them and the expert? And therefore we land at the representative number of three. To summarize what we have just said, the two options of individual expert and panel of three lay people both have sources in the Torah. One are the words of the Pasuk, Roshi HaMatos, in our Parsha, and the other is Gezeirah Shavah. Says the Chavos Yair, whenever you have a halacha, and you have perhaps two options, and one of them is the halacha as is derived from explicit words in the Pasuk, black on white, to read the words, and the other halacha derives from medrash halacha, from the exegetical principles of darshanic halacha, preference and prominence will be given to the halacha as emerges from the straightforward reading of the words, or that which is stated explicitly in the pasuk. Mefurash bakra, explicit in the pasuk, has precedence over expounded through halachic principles. And here, we must emphasize. It doesn't need to be emphasized, but we must emphasize. Things that are learned from Medrash Halacha, from the principles of Darshanic Halacha, are absolutely d'oraisa. There are capital punishments that are darshaned and applied through the principles of Medrash Halacha. So they are d'oraisa, absolutely. What we are being informed of here is that within the world of D'oraisa, there exists a hierarchy. Everything has crossed the threshold of D'oraisa, but still some are, I don't know how to say it, more D'oraisa than others, more equal than others. And this is an idea which actually is expressed by the Tosfos in a number of places, twice in Maseches Yuma, once in Yevamos, and elsewhere. And it's an amazing, especially within the context of a Chumash Shir. This is not a Halacha Shir. But to understand, of course, as we know, Medrash Halacha is such a major part of how Halacha works. And still to see that something that's explicit in the Chumash has that precedence, as we say. And therefore, coming back to our question, says the Chavris Yare, if you have two options, you can choose between the Yochid Mumcha, which emerges from the explicit words of Roshi Hamatos in our Pasuk, on the one hand. And on the other hand, the three-head Yotos, which emerges from Ekezer Roshava, you'll choose the explicit words. Rabbi Chonon Wasserman, that's Al, Hashem Inkom Domo, in his treatise, Kudros Divrei Sofrim, which is all about matters of Drabanan, and many other things, explains this idea based on a concept that we're already familiar with. It's an amazing association that he makes. We know in Parshas Chayei Sarah, we have the whole story that Eliezer, he goes to find a wife for Yitzhak, and the Torah tells us the story, and then we are told the story again through the words of Eliezer. And what does this teach us? Says Rashi, Yafasi Chosan Shel Abdi Ovis. You see how beloved the conversation of the servants of the Ovis are in the eyes of the Torah. How do you see how beloved it is? How do you see how important the Torah feels that it is? By how much space the Torah gives it. The Torah told it to us, and the Torah gives space for Eliezer to say it again. And what we see from here is that one of the ways that the Torah shows the significance of something, the prominence of something, is by the amount of space that it gives it in the Torah. And therefore, again, everything is d'oraisa. But the halacha that the Torah spoke out explicitly and gave voice to in words in the Torah itself, in the Chumash itself, it likewise has prominence. Now, before we take leave of this idea, it's worthwhile noting two things, one general comment and one specific comment for our context. Here we are saying that when it comes to halacha, we give precedence to that which is stated explicitly in the Torah over the Medrash halacha. That's not always true. In fact, it's so not always true that sometimes the Medrash halacha actually contravenes or overrides our understanding of the simple translation of the pasuk. An example, ayin tachas ayin, an eye for an eye. The Torah says if a person puts out someone's eye, his eye should be put out. Those words are black on white in the Torah. The pshat, according to many, is exactly that, an eye for an eye. Now, the Gemara in Baba Kama embarks on and engages in a lengthy discussion demonstrating from so many different ways, all of them medrash halacha, how this cannot be the halacha. And the halacha rather is financial compensation, which leads us to ask the question, the follow-up question, why then did the Torah write an eye for an eye, if that is not the halacha? That indeed is a question that needs to be answered. But the first stage is to establish through Medrash Halacha that the penalty for putting out someone's eye is not that the perpetrator's eye is put out. So that's a very important thing to note, because at the same time as we say that we give primacy to that which is written, we first need to establish what the halacha is, and sometimes Medrash Halacha can override the simple reading of the pasuk, leaving the simple reading for another Torah message, but not the halachic message. So one first needs to establish that indeed the words of the Torah are to be taken, to be construed as reflecting the actual halacha. Once that's true, the written words now have primacy over Medrash Halacha. So it's a bit of a complex situation, not surprisingly, in the interplay between the words of the Pasuk and the Halacha. What I found to be fascinating about this case specifically is here we are saying that we give primacy and precedence to that which is stated explicitly in the Pasuk. What are we dealing with? Two avenues for annulling vows. One comes from the words Roshi Hamatos, and the other from this Gezeirah Shavah. The entire concept of annulling vows is not stated explicitly in the Pasuk. It's actually famous for not being stated explicitly in the Pasuk, as the Mishnah says in Maseches Chagiga, Heter Nedarim Porchim Ba'avir. the concept of annulling vows, it floats in the air. That is to say, it's not an easy matter at all to be able to associate it. It could be that it's Torah Shebaal Peh. It's very, very heavily based on oral transmission, certainly not explicit. The Torah has about 16 or 17 psukim about what to do with vows, but it never openly says that it's possible through a Beis Din or through anyone to get an annulment of the vows. It's primarily Torah Shebaal Peh. So the very interesting situation here is that the whole institution is not mentioned explicitly in the Pasuk of Hataras Nedarim. Yet even so, within that, or on top of that, will give primacy to the avenue within this heavily Torah Shebaal Peh area to the one that has a basis in Torah Shebichtav of the words Rashi Amatos, as opposed to the Gezeirah Shava. So once again, a very nuanced situation here, but the Yesod is a major Yesod. It's discussed by the Stechemed and by the Prima Godim and by everyone, really. This idea of, we don't leave the words of the Chumash behind as we go into the world of Halacha. Rather, we take note of how the Halachas come out as we discussed here. So these are some thoughts with regards to the beginning of Matos. But let us now move to a parsha deeper in, which is Perek Lamed Beis. It's really the final Perek of Parshas Matos. It is the famous section of B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven. As we know, lands had been conquered. The land of Sichon and of Og had been conquered on the east side of the Jordan River. Now the land of Canaan is waiting for them on the west side. But you have these two tribes. Later on, half the tribe of Manasseh is added to them. And they request, for whatever reason, that they would like to stay on the east side. And moreover, after lengthy negotiations and discussions, that request is granted to them. And thus do they settle on the east side of the Yarden. Now, the question that, halachic question that we need to ask is, what does this say about the status of the east side of the Yarden? What is its position? Is it considered to be ultimately part of the land of Israel? Is it not considered part of the land of Israel? If it isn't, it's much, much harder to understand how they could be allowed just to stay outside the land of Israel. The land of Israel is the land for the Jewish people. And moreover, Moshe never really raises that objection. He says, they'll go to war, you can go to war, and so on. But Moshe doesn't really say the simplest thing, which is, why would you be staying in Chutz La'aretz? We're meant to be moving into the land of Israel. We do find, in many respects, somehow, that the east side of the Yarden, where these 2.5 tribes settled, has the status of Eretz Yisrael. And it has Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, somehow. Where do we see this? Well, the mitzvahs of Shemitah and of Truma and Maisra all apply also on the east side. And what's also very interesting, perhaps the most telling point here, is that the Yovel year requires all of the presence of the entire Jewish people in the land of Israel. As we say in Parshas Behar, Ukrosem Doror Ba'aretz L'chol Yoshveha. Liberty is proclaimed for all of its inhabitants, says the Gemara. That means the entire Jewish people need to be inhabiting the land of Israel. Bizman she Yoshveha Aleha, that's when you have the Yovel. Says the Gemara in Maseches Erechin and Daf Lamed Beis, at a certain point, the Yovel was discontinued. It was no longer operational on a Torah level. And what was that point? When, as we know, the two tribes, again, 2.5 tribes, the two tribes of Reuben and Gad, they were exiled first. They were actually the first of all of them to go into exile, a number of years before those on the west side of the Jordan River. Says the Gemara, at that point, the Yovel stopped, because you no longer have everyone living in the land of Israel. But what does that tell us? That tells us that until this point, we did have everyone living in the land of Israel, even though two of the tribes are living on the east side. That tells us that the east side is considered part of the broader Eretz Yisrael. So much so that as long as they're there, everyone's there. As soon as they go missing from there, so you don't have everyone in the land of Israel anymore. So on the one hand, we see that the east side of the Yarden does have the status and the Kedusha, to a degree, of Eretz Yisrael. Now, not with regards to everything. There is a very interesting Mishnah in Bikurim, which states that Bikurim are not brought from the east side of the Yarden. Now why? Why should Bikurim be different than Shemitah and Truma and Maaser or anything like that? The Mishnah says, records Rabbi Yossi Aglili, and there are other opinions as well, but Rabbi Yossi Aglili puts it very succinctly. One of the things that one needs to say when he brings Bikurim is referring to the land of Israel as Eretz Zavas Chalav U'Dvash, the land flowing with milk and honey. Says Rabbi Yossi Aglili, the east side of the Yarden is not the land about which is said Eretz Zavas Chalav U'Dvash. That's reserved for Eretz Canaan proper, meaning already on the west side. So this is very interesting. It turns out that there's a kind of a yes-no relationship in terms of the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. It has a Kedusha, but it's not the land flowing with milk and honey. So how does this work? And the most basic question is, how does the east side of the Yarden, if we assume that it's not part of the original Eretz Yisrael, how does it assume attain the Kedusha? How does it have the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael? There are those, without going into a major discussion that we've had in the past, there are those who see the east side, yes, as part of the original promised land, that the Sichon Melech HaEmori is part of the Emori of the seven kingdoms. But if we assume that it was not originally part of the land, how did it become the land? However, it happens to be that there is a mechanism whereby a land that is not originally part of Eretz Yisrael, but actually is adjacent to the land of Israel, the Kedusha can spread out. It's almost like Tosefes Shabbos, Tosefes Yom Tov. The Kedusha can spread to adjacent lands under certain circumstances. That is based on a pasuk at the end of Parshas Ekev, where Hashem says to Moshe, wherever you step will be the land. Kol makom asher tedroch kaf raglecha. And the Sifrei says, even outside of the land of Israel, if the Jewish people expand their presence there, it can attain the status of Eretz Yisrael. That is what's happening here. The first time in history this ever happened was with these two lands on the east side of the Yarden, as per this idea of kol makom asher tedroch Kaf Raglecha, expansion of Eretz Yisrael. Not the most popular of topics nowadays in the world press, but it's a halachic concept, and that's more important. But here we have a basic question, and that is this idea of spreading the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael to adjacent territories. That presupposes that the land itself already has been established and has already been settled. Once that has happened, so then it can begin to spread outwards. Here, of course, the opposite is the case, because we're talking about spreading before we've even entered the land. And that seems to be a more unusual situation. Again, if the question is clear, and the Sifrei, by the way, explicitly states this, that the spreading of the Kedusha can only happen once the Jewish people are in their land, then they can start to spread outwards. But here, the spread comes even before the entry into the land. How is that possible? And this question is discussed, among others, by the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, and the Orach Chaim says, our case is different. If we hear this, it says, subtle point, but it's a world of difference. When we say that the Jewish people need to be in their land first, established, and then they can start to spread outwards, as opposed to vice versa, where conquer that territory, without even having entered their land. That's because it all begins with the land of Israel. It has to somehow be spreading out from the Kedusha of the land of Israel. And if you go somewhere else first and conquer somewhere else first, what's that got to do with anything? In our case, it's different. As true as it is that the lands of Sichon and Og were both conquered before the land of Canaan itself, but they were conquered apropos of the conquest of Eretz Canaan. They were conquered not only as a prelude, but as a precedent to, because the Jewish people are looking to enter the land. Sichon and Og were given the option to let them through. It's an option they didn't take. Rather, they went to war. In other words, the conquest of the lands of Sichon and Og was done in order. This was to facilitate and to enable the conquest of Eretz Canaan. Through that, they're able to enter the land. And therefore, there's much more of a shaychus to the land of Israel itself with the conquest of these territories, even though it happened first. And this now is an amazing situation, certainly one for the books. The very first case of expanding the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael was already an exception to the rule. The rule is Eretz Yisrael first, then expand. But here, in order to get to Eretz Yisrael, this conquest needs to happen. It's already, if we could call it, an Eretz Yisraelica conquest. And therefore, it enjoys the ability of the expansion of the Kedusha of the land. At the same time, we find something very interesting. And perhaps it can be understood in light of our discussion now. Moshe says not only do they also need to go to war, those two tribes, but also part of the negotiations is that they won't really come back to their families and fully settle these territories until the Jewish people are established in their land, on the west side. Now, of course, one could understand this on a straightforward level. It's a gesture of altruism and unity and many things. But in terms of our discussion, as Mefarshim point out, perhaps we can understand that this is in order to bestow upon their territory the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. As far as possible, Eretz Yisrael comes first, and then it can spread out. Now, in terms of the conquest, necessarily, they conquered these areas on the east side before moving into Eretz Canaan. That may well be. But once that's already happened, what will now fully bestow upon these territories the status and the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael? At this point, it can already be Eretz Yisrael first. Let that be established, let everyone be settled where they are. Then when they come back to settle on the east side, it will be a sequential expansion of Eretz Yisrael first and then moving out to the east side. So once again, as we look at the psukim, as we look at the elements at play here, we see it's a complex situation how exactly the land on the east side of the Yarden came to attain the status that it did to the extent that it did. So these are some classic discussions from Parshas Matos, and from there we move to Parshas Maaseh. And Maaseh, of course, begins with the detailing of the journeys of the Jewish people, Eile Maaseh Bnei Yisrael, Asher Yatzu Mimitzrayim, Mitzivosam, Biyad Moshe V'Aaron, and it keeps going. The famous 42 Masos. There is a minhag, actually, I'm not sure how widespread it is, but certainly something that many may have heard, of actually ascribing a special tune to these Masos, Vayichanu from here, Vayachanu from here, and it's given its own tune. It's almost like a self-contained parsha in that way. And by and large, its places, location A to B, from B to C. But there is one notable case. It's not the only case, but it is a notable case, and we stop, and there's a good bit of elaboration. And that is to be found in Perik Lamed, Pasuk Lamed Zayin, from Lamed Zayin to Mem Aleph, which is a good five psukim. And let us read the psukim and then raise the relevant question. So here we are in the beginning of Maaseh, Bamidbar Perik Lamed Gimel, and we'll begin with Pasuk Lamed Zayin, Vayis Umi Kodesh. They travel from Kodesh. Vayachanu behor ha'har, they encamp in this place or ha'har, b'ktzei eretz Edom. At the edge of the land of Edom. Okay, then what? Pasuk lamed ches. Vaya'al Aaron ha'kohen el hor ha'har. Al pi Hashem, vayom Hashem. Aaron ascends this mountain. He dies there. Bishnas harboim, let's say b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim. In the 40th year, from leaving Mitzrayim. Achodesh ha'chamishi be'achat achodesh. On the fifth month, the first of the month. Lamentes, further information. The Aaron ben Shalosh Besrim Ma'at Shana, Bemosa Behor Ha'har. He was 123 years old when he died there. Pasuk Mem, more information. Vayishma Kanani Melech Arad, Vuyoshe Banega Be'eretz Kanan, Bebo Yisrael. The Kanani heard that the Jewish people are approaching. And then, finally, in Pasuk Mem Aleph, we keep moving. We go back to the travels, back to the journeyings. Ayusumi ha-ha-har, v'yachudu b'tzalmona, and so on, until we get to the plains of Moab. Needless to say, there are a number of questions to be raised here. Some of them, actually, we've raised in a previous year, but there are new questions, and also the entire thing will be looked at from an entirely new angle. And not surprisingly, the Baal HaAngel here is Reb Leif Mintzberg in the Ben Melech. The first thing we note, as we go back to Pasuk Lamed Ches, we were told that Aaron died, B'chodesh HaChamishi Be'echad LaChodesh. In the fifth month, on the first of the month. It is very noteworthy indeed. Aaron is the only individual in the entire Chumash where we are told the date of his passing. The fifth month, the first of the month. We are not told this about anyone else in Chumash. Not the Avos, not the Imos, not Moshe Rabbeinu, not any of the Shvatim, and so on. Halo Davarhu. We have Mesoros, we have traditions. But black and white, again, in the Chumash, only Aaron certainly needs to be reckoned with. Also interesting is that this information, the date of the passing of Aaron, the passing of Aaron itself has been mentioned already in the Chumash. This is a recap. In the passing of Aaron itself has been mentioned in Parshas Chukas, in Perikav Aleph. And the date of his passing was not mentioned there. And that is also unusual now, because generally speaking, a recap, we assume, will be a synopsis, a more summarized version. We're not expecting to find pertinent information in the recap that we didn't actually have when the event was described in real time. But that's what's happening here. If you learn Parshas Chukas, you'd never know the date of Aaron's passing. You need to get to the review, quote-unquote, here in Parshas Maaseh in order to find that out. And why is that so? But this, one could say, leads to a more basic question, and that is, why is the passing of Aaron being discussed in Parshas Maaseh? As far as we know, Maaseh is the journeyings, and journeyings involve going from A to B and B to C, which is, for the main part, exactly what happens. It's the locations. Why does the Torah stop and tell us in this place, this is what happened? These are three very basic questions, and they're questions we've discussed in the past, but here is a fourth question, which is, it's stunning because it's right in front of our eyes. Pasuk Lamed Tes says, Aaron was ben shalosh, v'srim u'ma'as shana, v'mosu bar, he's 123 years old. The next pasuk, the king, the Kanani, he hears that the Jewish people are coming, okay? And then they keep going. In between Pasuk Lamites and Pasuk Mem, if you look in the Chumash, is a Samach. A Samach denotes what's called a Parsha Stuma. Parshas, as far as the Halacha is concerned, don't refer to the weekly Parsha, but refer to the paragraphs in the Torah. And there's two types of paragraphs. There's Parsha Stuma and Parsha Psucha, which then in the Chumash will be either a Samach or a Pei. Parsha Stuma means that it's not just a run of words, but rather the first paragraph ends and the second paragraph begins later on that line. So it's closed up, in a sense, Satum. That's why it's called the Samach Stuma. If you look in a Sefer Torah, you will see that Pasuk Mem begins later on the very same line that Pasuk Lamites ended. Parsha Psucha is when the line is left open till the end and the next paragraph begins on the next line. Closer to what we would call, Lahavdil, a paragraph. Either way, regardless of the difference between them, they're both paragraphs. They're both new paragraphs. And now the question is, not only do we seem to have perhaps digressed, because we're just really looking to chart the path of the Jewish people, A to B and B to C, from journeys number 1 to 42, it's one run. Effectively, it's one topic. Here, mid-topic, we have a break of a paragraph. It's like a new parsha within this digression. What is a new parsha of the Torah doing in the middle of a digression, in the middle of one of the 42 journeys? That is the question. And Rav Mintzberg explains as follows. The truth is that whenever we talk about a journey, so we talk about where are we coming from and where are we going to. Now, on a very itemized level, there's 42 answers to that question. But on an uber level, on a most meta level, there's only really one answer. We are coming from the land of Egypt, going to the land of Canaan. I mean, if we put it in one sentence, that's what's happening. And that's very interesting, because it's clear that the early journeyings are much more framed in terms of leaving Mitzrayim. And obviously at a certain point, we will no longer be talking about leaving Mitzrayim, but we'll be talking about journeying towards Eretz Yisrael. The Shaila is, where's the transition? At what point does it turn? At what point do we stop, so to speak, leaving Mitzrayim and start entering the land of Israel? Interesting Shaila. Again, it will always be both to a degree. But at what point is the primary vector where we're coming from, and when does it transition to where we're headed towards? Well, in Parshas Chukas, we're told that after the death of Aaron, the Kanani heard that the Jewish people are coming. We spoke about these psukim two or three weeks ago. The Jewish people are approaching the land. Derech Ha'asarim. Derech Ha'asarim means the way that people who visit the land are entering, that's how they're entering. Ha'atarim is explained like Tarim, like Zroa, like Ezroa. And he goes out to wage war. The very first war ever waged against the Jewish people who looked like they're about to enter the land was by this Kanani, whoever the Kanani is, Kanani Melech Arad, because the Jewish people are coming Derech HaTarim. When you reach that point and you keep going, you're entering the land of Israel. And he already wants to block them at that stage. This happened when the Jewish people were at Hor HaHar, were by that mountain. At that place, if they move any closer, they're coming into the land of Israel, he comes out to wage war against them. What does this have to do with Aaron? Says Rav Mintzberg, Aaron and Moshe are partners in many, many enterprises. Among them, taking the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim, and in principle, or in theory, bringing them into the land of Canaan. Now the notion that they are partners in taking the Jewish people out of Eretz Canaan, we might not have framed it in that way, or understood it in that way, but that's exactly what the Pasuk says. It's the opening Pasuk of Parshas Maaseh. Eile Maaseh b'nei Yisrael. These are the journeys of the Jewish people. They've left the land of Egypt, biyad Moshe v'Aaron, in the hand of Moshe and Aaron. So here is the Torah saying that the agents for us leaving are Moshe and Aaron. And that's meant, that is meant to reach its culmination in bringing the Jewish people into the land of Canaan. Now, as we know, as a result of the Meriva, whatever happened by the rock there, it was decreed upon Moshe and Aaron, Lachein lo taviyu. And there again you see, Hashem speaks to Moshe and Aaron and says, therefore you, plural, neither of you will bring the people into the land. Lo taviyu, esam, el aretz. What that means is, the entry of the Jewish people into the land and the passing of Moshe and Aaron go together, because they cannot be there when that happens. Not only will they not bring them in, they won't come in themselves, and they need to leave this world before the Jewish people enter the land. The question is, when did the Jewish people enter the land? How would we timestamp the entry of the Jewish people into Eretz Canaan? Well, as with many things, you can put it down to a day if you want, literally the day that we crossed the River Jordan. But that's not when our entry to the land began. When did our entry to the land begin? When we moved from when we arrived in Hor HaHar and are ready to move on and keep going. Because we are already in Derech Ha'atarim. We're already in the threshold of the land of Canaan. If you keep moving, you're basically, you're making to enter the land. And therefore, to move in that direction is already the beginning of the process. As an event, the entry into the land took place on the 10th of Nisan when we crossed the Yarden. But as a process, it began as soon as we keep moving from Hor HaHar, because that's already the entrance way in these adjacent territories to the land of Israel. It's for this reason, and because it's a process that begins in Hor HaHar and ends just before we cross the Yarden, that's why it's bracketed by the passing of Aaron at the beginning and Moshe at the end. As much as they are partners, but it's fair to say that Moshe is the primary protagonist. His leadership is yet needed for the Jewish people to communicate the Torah, and therefore the extent to which it's a composite partnership, but entering the land of Israel is a composite experience. As it begins, the partnership begins to be unraveled, and Aaron already passes. And that's why the Torah mentions the passing of Aaron in Parshas Maaseh. It mentions it again, because this is the turning point. What is Maaseh about? The journey to the Jewish people. Journey from where? From the land of Mitzrayim. To where? To the land of Canaan. At what point does it stop being the one and start being the other? At the point that Aaron dies. At the point that they're now moving into Eretz Canaan. In the more expanded sense of the word, that they're already making their overtures towards entering the land. At that point, Aaron already cannot be there. And that, says Rav Mintzberg, is why there is a samach in the middle of this section. That samach means a section has ended, a parsha has ended, and a new parsha is beginning. Well, parsha has ended. I thought we're in the middle of the Masos. As far as we know, it's not over until you get to number 42. But no, the parsha that's ended are the journeyings away from Eretz Mitzrayim, including all the wanderings in the Midbar. And that point now, end of that parsha, new parsha now, entry into the land of Canaan, which begins with moving on from Hor HaHar. The Canaani hears about it. He makes his he reacts in the way that he does, and that's why you have two parshas within this opening section of Parshas Maaseh. And what does that mean in terms of the timing? We're given the date, and the date is the beginning of the fifth month. What does this mean? So Rav Mintzberg says as follows. The Jewish people begin in the month of Nisan. Achodesh Hazalachem Rosh Chodeshim, that's when we leave Mitzrayim, and that's when our year begins, that's when our status as a nation begins. Now, if it begins at Nisan, it can continue, the process can continue into later months. as long as it's a continuum, it's rooted in Nisan and it keeps going. And what's an example of something that's rooted in Nisan and can progresses to a later month? The giving of the Torah. Everything was proceeding as it should be. They started in Nisan, but now it's already Sivan and it's time to receive the Torah. Should there ever be somehow a breakdown of something that's meant to happen to the Jewish people that doesn't, it gets interrupted. So when it's resumed, it will be reset to Nisan because it's a new beginning. And what is an example of that? If that sounds maybe a little abstract, what's an example of that? The Mishkan. Now for Rashi, the entire Mishkan was only said after the Chet HaEgel. But according to the Ramban, the Mishkan is meant to be also a continuation. It's a progression. Leaving Mitzrayim, getting the Torah, building the Mishkan. But things got disrupted through the Chet HaEgel. And looked like the Jewish people themselves were under threat. And now, when everything comes back again, it's reset. But if it's reset, then it starts again. And when was the Mishkan inaugurated? The month of Nisan. It's got to be. If you're starting again, you start when the Jewish people start. The truth is, exactly the same thing happened with regards to the entry into Eretz Canaan. We were meant to move, keep going, moving, and had the Meraglim not returned with the report that they did, and had the people not believed them in the way that they did, that would have been a progression and keeping on moving towards the land of Canaan. As we know, that too got disrupted. And you have now 40 years in the Midbar, including the first and the final year, but you have major, major break. And now things are being resumed. It's time to start again. And yes to move into the land of Canaan. We won't be surprised to hear now that the time that we actually moved into the land of Canaan, crossed over the Yarden, was during the month of Nisan, the 10th of Nisan. In fact, the 10th of Nisan dates itself specifically back to the beginnings of our leaving Mitzrayim. Because the 10th of Nisan is when we took the Korban Pesach, 4 days before Pesach itself. We were ready, in a sense, breaking out. And that now, 40 years later, becomes, if we have to pick up again, we pick up again in Nisan. And so we did. But isn't it also true that the month where we would have begun to enter the land was the month of Av? Because the Meraglim came back on Tisha B'Av. And because we believed them, so everything went the direction that it did. But had we not believed them, or had they come back with a positive report, the month of, we would have, from that point onwards, been moving directly towards the land of Canaan. That journey, the beginning of moving towards the, decisively towards the land, is reclaimed in our parsha. As soon as the month of Av and that final year comes, and the Torah makes a point of it. So Aaron can no longer be here because the Jewish people are moving towards Eretz Canaan. And why are they moving towards the month of Av? Because the month of Av was the month that they were originally meant to move towards. So again, it's an amazing blend. In terms of the final, decisive crossing into the Yarden, we start again and it's in Nisan. But in terms of how it all begins, it all starts with the month of Av, as it was intended to. And what's fascinating is, and here's Rav Mintzberg, the whole Torah open before him, says this was a timeline and a time frame that was echoed later on in our history. And that is, here we are discussing the first time the Jewish people enter the land of Canaan. They would enter the land of Israel again under the auspices of Ezra. And in Sefer Ezra, in Perek Zion, Pasuk Zion, it says, so we have the Vayalub Mibnei Yisrael, Mina Kohanim Halviyim. They're all entering Yerushalayim. When did they get there? Pasuk Ches of Ezra Perik Zion. Vayavo Yerushalayim, this group came to Yerushalayim, Bachodesh HaChamishi. In the fifth month, they arrived in the fifth month. Yishnat Sashvias, the Melech in the seventh year of the king. When did this all begin? Pasuk Tes. Ki be'echad l'chodesh harishon hu yusud hamala mibavo. At the beginning of the first month, Nisan, they left Bavo. Ve'echad l'chodesh hachamishi, in the beginning of the fifth month, Av ba el Yerushalayim. So it's an amazing situation. We find the elements, in a sense, are reversed, but it's actually closer to how it originally should have been. We also left Mitzrayim in Nisan and should have been moving towards Eretz Canaan in that Chodesh Av. And that's exactly what Ezra did. He left Bavel in Nisan, he came to Yerushalayim in Av, and that's getting closer to reclaiming the original line of travel that the Jewish people ultimately need to re-experience. So these are the comments of Reb Mintzberg, once again, sweeping through, illuminating, paying attention to so many different aspects of what's going on in the Pasuk, and putting it all together. I want to move to, for a moment, to the final Pasuk of Maaseh, and it reads as follows. Eila mitzvos v'mishpatim asher tziva Hashem b'yad Moshe u'b'nei Yisrael. The mitzvahs, the laws that Hashem commanded through the hand of Moshe u'b'nei Yisrael, ba'arvos mo v'yodein yirecha. I mean, that is a pasuk of summation. And then, chazak, chazak, v'nes chazak. It's very interesting to compare the final pasuk of Parshas of Chumash Bamidbar with the final pasuk of Chumash Bayikra. They're very similar to each other. In the end of Ayikra, it says, Eila ha-mitzvos asher tziva Hashem es Moshe al b'nei Yisrael b'har Sinai. So these are two Eila ha-mitzvos. Are there any differences between them? Well, the earlier one is b'har Sinai, and this is b'ayodein Yirecho. Obviously, they're in two different locations. Rabbeinu Bachya also notes that in Vayikra, it says Eila ha-mitzvos. In our pasuk, it says Eila ha-mitzvos v'ha-mishpatim. Why are the mishpatim at the end of Bamidbar and no mishpatim in the pasuk at the end of Vayikra? For a very simple reason, says Rabbeinu Bachya. There aren't really any mishpatim in Chumash Vayikra, but there are in Chumash Bamidbar. Chumash Bamidbar has the mishpat of Nachala, of inheritance, and other matters as well. So because there's mishpatim in Bamidbar, so this, the concluding pasuk mentions mishpatim. But there is another very interesting difference, and that is Moshe's role. In Chumash Vayikra, it says, Asher tziva Hashem es Moshe al b'nei Yisrael. Hashem commanded Moshe towards b'nei Yisrael. In Bamidbar, the end of Bamidbar, it says, Asher tziva Hashem biyad Moshe al b'nei Yisrael, in the hand of Moshe. They both seem substantially to be saying the same thing, but they're not exactly the same thing. And specifically, then, why is Yad Moshe mentioned in the end of Bamidbar and not in the end of Vayikra? A very interesting question. And other Mefarshim deal with this as well. And Rabbeinu Bachya gives a fascinating answer. The end of Vayikra discusses things that were given Bahar Sinai. I mean, that's how the pasuk concludes. Bahar Sinai. Bahar starts by Dabar Hashem Moshe Bahar Sinai Lemor. Bahar and Bechu Kosar were both set at Har Sinai. So much so, according to some Mefarshim, they are the Sefer HaBris. In Parshas Mishpatim, we find that Moshe took a Sefer, it's called the Sefer HaBris, and he read it before the people. The Ibn Ezra and others say the Sefer HaBris was the Parshas of Bahar and Bechu Kosar. Eile Divrei HaBris. Now, what happened with that first covenant at Sinai? The Jewish people broke it by making the egel. And as a result of making the egel, Moshe broke the luchos in Yonah Diyoma with his hands. And therefore, says Rabbeinu Bachya, the Torah doesn't mention Yad Moshe in the end of Vayikra, because the bris that the parshas at the end of Vayikra are talking about, the bris of Sinai, was not affirmed by the hand of Moshe. It was broken by the hand of Moshe. Of course, not Moshe broke it. He broke the luchos because the people broke the bris. And therefore, it's ill-advised and not appropriate, not auspicious to mention the hand of Moshe within the bris, where the hand of Moshe had no choice but to respond to the fact that the people broke the bris. But then it was reinstated. It was renewed. As we're told in Parshas Kisisa, Hinei Anochi Kares Bris. The bris is renewed. And that bris was never broken. For all of the tragedy and the disaster of the spies, but the bris was never considered to be broken, and it remained intact. And therefore the hand of Moshe is mentioned as part of the second bris, but not mentioned as part of the first. Amazing response to that nuance within these two concluding psukim. And I'd like to perhaps add another concluding idea. We mentioned that between the journeys away from Mitzrayim and the journeys towards the land of Israel, there is a samach, and that represents a parsha stuma. That means it's a new parsha. One, the travels away from Egypt have ended, the travels towards the land of Israel have begun. There's two types of new paragraphs, as we've mentioned. Psuche and stuma. Psuche means the next paragraph begins on the next line. Stuma means it begins at the end of the line where the first one ended. And that, say, the Mefarshim shows a connection between the two. Because ultimately, as much as there's a shift in emphasis now, and now we speak about not so much moving away from Egypt, but moving towards the land of Israel, But every journey towards the land of Israel is connected to every journey that was away from the land of Egypt. Because whatever needed to happen in order to deal with distancing ourselves from Egypt and everything that was represented by that, ultimately is also, an expanded sense, is a prelude to our entry into the land of Israel. So it is a new parsha, but it's not completely disconnected. The final few journeys that are actually moving into the land of Israel, they're different than the early journeys, but they're not disconnected from them. Those early journeys ultimately are necessary. Which means in an expanded sense, all the 42 journeys are journeys towards the land of Israel. Some Mefarshim say the reason why there's a special tune to which these 42 journeys are lained or sung is because it is a song of the love of entering the land of Israel. And that begins from journey number one. And it's interesting, again, these are minhagim. So one has to be sensitive to the voice of minhagim. Every time I've heard that tune, that special tune for the Masos, it's the same tune as Az Yashir. And Az Yashir is the very first time that Israel is now on the map and the focus of where the journey is from. And in an expanded sense, all these 42 journeys, they're all Az Yashir. Because they're all moving towards, as much as they don't seem to be getting there in a straight line, but in the end, it's all part of the song. And this, of course, is so apropos, again, of the days and the weeks that we are in, where every Golus really is somehow either in the land of Egypt, trying to get out of it, and all of those experiences ultimately are all part of what is getting the Jewish people back towards the land of Israel. We mentioned the Megale Amukos, I think, not too long ago, when we say, Umevi Goel Livnei B'nehem. Mevi is in the present tense. Everything that happens in Golos is bringing the Geula, it's preparing the Jewish people in ways that we cannot always fathom. Sometimes it boggles the mind and sometimes it defies the imagination. But Umevi Goel means it's an ongoing process, and as the Megale Amukos points out, the word Mevi, Megale Amukos, the word Mevi has the four letters Mem, Beis, Yud, and Aleph, which is Modai, Bavel, Yavon, and Edom. Everything that happened in all of those exiles is also part of Mevi Goel, as we see in the Parsha of Maaseh, and we're looking to bring to bring the song to its conclusion, to see much more clearly the element of entering the land of Israel with the full Geula. But when we do, Mitzvah Hashem, we will look back, and the song is on the entire thing, and we hope to get there soon. Soros, Tovos, Vikarov, Laklal, Vlaprat, all the very best.